the familiar-looking man said. No, my name is Finkelstein.
You were in Krakow, weren't you?
The other man said.
You were one of the Judenrat's policemen.
Of course. That's why I remembered him. How could I have forgotten that face? He was the man who had brought the Nazis to my flat. The one who had stolen everything else from us while the Nazi took my mother's ring. I remembered my mother's eyes that day. The emptiness that had never completely gone away. I'd been so scared, so protective, that I hadn't even felt anger. I did now.
No,
the policeman said. There was panic in his eyes.
My name is Finkelstein, from Jelonki.
Quiet in there,
a capo's voice shouted from outside. The two men said nothing more to the policeman, but they watched him all the way back to their bunks. That night, I could hear the man crying softly in his bed, until someone hissed at him to shut up. The morning was cold, with only lukewarm coffee-flavored water to fight off the chill. It was colder still underground, where it was always damp and the sun never shone. The low ceiling made us all walk like old crones, and I noticed that even when they could, some of the old-timers never stood up straight anymore. Their backs were permanently bent. I was given my own carbide light, my own pickaxe, and my own place to work. It was heavy work and boring. There was nothing to it but swinging my pickaxe again and again, breaking off big chunks of salt that another prisoner shoveled into a donkey cart. I chipped away, my arms already starting to ache from weakness and malnutrition, when I heard someone cry out from the chamber around the corner from mine.
What's this? How did this happen? Who's done this?
It was the voice of one of the capos. It wasn't said in the tone the capos used to taunt us or goad us into working harder. This was something different. Something confused. Something scared. The other capos heard it in his voice right away and ran around the corner to help. Without guards, we put down our picks and our shovels and hurried to peek around the corner behind them. It was the Judenrat policeman. Holtzmann, or Finkelstein, or whatever his name was. His head had been smashed in with a shovel, and the rest of his body was gashed and torn and bleeding. In the carbide light from a dozen watching headlamps, something glittered and shone in his cuts. Salt. Someone had rubbed salt in all his wounds. Like Abimelech, in the Book of Judges, who sowed the fields of his own people with salt after he put down their rebellion. I remember reading about him while studying the Torah with my father, long before the war. This was punishment and purification, all in one.
I said I want to know who did this,
the capo yelled. I looked around from face to face, trying to see who had done it. The men who had accused him in the barracks weren't there. It could have been any of them. It could have been all of them. No one said anything, and I worried we would all be whipped for the crime. But the capo only shook his head.
What do I care if you kill one another? You'll all be dead soon enough anyhow. You, and you,
he said, pointing to two of the prisoners watching nearby.
Drag his body out of here, weight him down, and dump him in the underground lake.
No one said another word about him. The capos sent us back to our places, and I chipped away at the salt wall again until they told me to stop. That night, I dreamed the salt statues came to life and set on our captors with their swords. But every one of the statues had the face of the dead man. Chabinya Concentration Camp, 1944. Chapter 14. Our job was to move a pile of rocks. They were big rocks, and it was a big pile. The rocks were heavy and rough, and we were given no wheelbarrows or gloves. The rocks had to be moved from one side of the assembly field to another, and the Nazis yelled at us and beat us if we were too slow, or if they thought we were carrying a rock that was too small for us. I put my arms around another stone and lifted, my back crying out in pain. The rock tore and scraped at my skin as I cradled it to my chest and staggered across the yard to dump it in the new pile. Then I did it again. And again. One of the other men stumbled and collapsed, and the guards fell on him with sticks and clubs. I hefted another rock and kept working while I tried not to let the Nazis see how afraid I was. They were like Amon Goethe's dogs. They could smell fear on you, and they liked nothing better than to attack when you were at your weakest. By midday, my arms and hands and chest were so raw and bruised I couldn't have gone on. But by then we were finished. I would have dropped to the ground, but I knew I would just be beaten for it. So I stood with the others, wobbling on my shaking legs while I waited for the guards to tell us what new task awaited us.
"Good," the SS officer in charge of us said. "Now move it back."
I blinked, stupidly, not understanding at first. We had just worked all morning to move this pile of stones across the camp, and now the Nazis were changing their minds? The other prisoners and I looked at one another to see if we had heard right.
"I said move this pile back to where it was,"
the SS officer yelled. He moved through our group, hitting us with a stick until we moved.
"You will move it to where it was, and then you will move it again. Now work."
Such was life at the Chabinya concentration camp. I had been transferred there after a short time mining salt at Vialichka. Vialichka had been hard, but Chabinya was worse, because at Chabinya the Nazis played games. The Nazis were making us work just to work. This was all a game to them, like a hand of cards or a soccer match. We were the ball, to be kicked around for their sport. My arms shook as I picked up the same stone that I had just carried across the compound. But not from weariness this time. From fury. I fumed as I hefted the stone and trudged back across the muddy compound. But they wanted me to be angry. They wanted me to say something, or frown, or mumble curses at them. They were watching me for it. Watching all of us. Like schoolyard bullies, they wanted to provoke us, and then they would beat us as punishment. At Chabinya, I worked all day moving piles of rocks back and forth, digging holes 6 feet deep, and then filling them back in again. I ate watery broth and week-old bread once a night, and passed out on a wooden pallet with no mattresses or pillows or blankets. I was an animal to them, a pack mule. But beasts were never treated so poorly. Working animals were expensive. They had value. I was a Jew. We were lower than animals. They could kill as many of us as they wanted, and there would always be another trainload of us to take our place. But as angry as I was at the Nazis, I was even angrier at my fellow prisoners. How could we take this abuse so quietly, so meekly, with our heads bowed and a quick tip of the cap to our killers? Yes, the Nazis had clubs and guns, but there were far more of us than there were of them. If we turned on them all at once, we could overcome them. We were not animals to be led to the slaughter. We were thinking, feeling human beings. One day, in the middle of hauling rocks again, I vowed not to be killed without a fight. My father, Uncle Moshe, the Jewish elders, they were all wrong. We shouldn't be trying to survive. We should be trying to win. Instead of waiting for the British or the Americans or the Russians to save us, we should be saving ourselves. I'm not going to let them line me up on the edge of a pit and shoot me, I told myself. I will fight back. I will kick the Nazis in the shins. I will run. I won't go like a sheep to the slaughter. At roll call that night, someone else had the same thought. One of the Nazis struck him with a club, but instead of taking the beating meekly, the prisoner raised his arms and grabbed the stick. He wrestled it from the shocked officer's hands and struck him with it in the head, knocking his Nazi hat into the muck, striking his raised arms again and again. Yes! Yes, I thought. It begins here. Together we can take them all. I looked around anxiously to see if anyone else felt as I did, if anyone else would take up the charge. But everyone had their heads down. No! This was our chance! If we fought together... Crack! I jumped at the sound. With the fiery spark of a pistol, it was all over. The prisoner who had fought back crumpled to the ground, dead from a bullet to the brain, and the assaulted officer was hurried away from the assembly grounds. The camp soldiers appeared in force around the edges of our lines, pointing rifles at us, and the camp commandant hurried out from his cozy office. When he heard the report from his officers, he turned on the prisoners.
You!
He cried, pointing at a boy who had been standing right next to the man who fought back.
You were a part of this plot to escape!
What?
The boy stammered. He wasn't much older than me.
No, I didn't even know him.
Guards grabbed the boy and dragged him to the front of our lines where the Nazis had built a gallows for hanging prisoners.
And this man, the commandant said, pointing into the crowd. And this one, and him, and him, and him.
He was picking people at random now in his fury, punishing innocent people for the dead man's effrontery. I shrank back. I recognized the boy and two of the other men from my barrack. Like me, they couldn't even have known who the dead man was.
I'm innocent,
the boy my age sobbed as they dragged him up onto the gallows and put the hangman's noose around his neck.
I never tried to escape. I promise, I've done everything you asked.
I shook with helplessness and rage, but also with fear. This is what fighting back earned you. More abuse. More death. Half a dozen Jews would be murdered today because one man refused to die without a fight. To fight back was to die quickly, and to take others with you. This was why prisoners went meekly to their deaths. I had been so resolved to fight back, but I knew then that I wouldn't. To suffer quietly hurt only you. To suffer loudly, violently, angrily. To fight back was to bring hurt and pain and death to others.
Please, the boy cried. I never tried to escape. I'm innocent.
He looked out on all of us, those of us with the courage to look up from the ground.
Remember,
he begged us.
I did nothing.
The hangman kicked the chair out from under him, and the boy's body jerked as his neck was broken. I kept my head held high and watched, vowing never to forget. Chapter 15. My work detail was on its way to the quarry to break more rocks one morning when another capo came to speak to ours. The two capos talked for a moment, and our capo ordered us to stop. I kept my head down but tried to look around with my eyes to see what was going on. Something different was happening, and different was never good. Our capo kept us standing there without saying anything else for a long time. What was happening? Why had we stopped? Were we in trouble? Were we going to be killed? The other prisoners had to be asking themselves the same questions, but of course none of us spoke. To speak was to invite a beating. We would be told our fates when our captors decided we needed to know.
Turn around, our capo said at last. March!
We headed away from the quarry, which would have been a relief if I thought we were going someplace better. We passed a place where prisoners were shot over the pits they had dug for themselves, and I said a silent prayer of thanks. But then we passed the barracks and the main gate. We were being marched to the depot. A train waited at the side rail, but it didn't have passenger cars. It was fitted out with cattle cars. We were to be transported like livestock. We were herded up a ramp into one of the train cars under the whips and clubs of the capos and SS officers. I was one of the first ones inside. The car was empty and looked recently washed, but it smelled of urine and vomit and excrement. I reeled back, but there was nowhere to go.
In! In!
The guards yelled at us, and I was pushed up against the far wall.
More and more prisoners were forced into the car. They packed so many of us in, I was crushed between three other men and the wall, but it was like that for everyone. I couldn't even raise my arm. I felt trapped again, like I had felt under the floorboards and down in the salt mine. I couldn't be here. I had to have space. Air.
"I can't breathe! I can't breathe!"
A man at the other end of the car started to scream, giving voice to my panic.
"Let me out! I need to get out of here!"
He kicked at the wall of the cattle car.
"Please! I can't take it!"
Crack! An SS officer shot the man through the wall of the cattle car, and he no longer had to worry about not being able to breathe. If I panicked, if I broke, I would suffer the same fate. Instead, I worked my way toward a ventilation grate on the wall of the train car and pressed my face up against it, breathing in the fresh air from outside. My heart still raced, but at least I could breathe. We stood squeezed into the train car for half a day while the Nazis loaded more prisoners into other cars. We had no food, no water, and no way to go to the bathroom. Soon I understood why the train car had smelled so bad, and would only smell worse before this ordeal was through. Late in the afternoon, the train lurched and we were away. None of us knew where we were going. I hoped it would be better than Chibinya, but by now I knew not to dream. False hope only made things worse. It was cold along the wall of the cattle car. Wind whipped through the spaces in between the car's wooden slats, making me shiver. But at least I had air. The prisoners in the middle complained of it being too hot and too close, and of not being able to breathe. So I shivered while I sucked the freezing air into my lungs, and I didn't complain. As the train made its way to wherever we were going, I watched the landscape slide by. Płaszów, Wieliczka, Chibinia. They had all been right around Kraków, my home. Now I was truly leaving home and seeing the outside world for the first time. I had never imagined it would be under these circumstances. I saw snow-covered fields, farmhouses with electric lights burning in the windows, forests, a river, a busy road with cars and trucks. After all my time in the work camps, it was strange to see people in the real world, eating dinner and going to school and watching movies. But that was the world for non-Jews. My world was concentration camps and salt mines, starvation, and cattle cars. The train slowed, and the other prisoners began to stir. Were we at our final destination? Did anyone recognize where we were? I watched through the grate as a little train station slid into view, but I couldn't make out the name on the station sign. I could see people, though. Regular people. Polish men carrying briefcases. Polish women pushing strollers. A child in a blue coat pointed at our train, and her mother turned her away. Two boys waited with their parents beside a stack of luggage. They were going on a trip, maybe on vacation.
"They're going to turn you into soap, Jews!"
one of the boys yelled. He couldn't have been much older than 5 or 6.
"No," his older brother said. "They're taking you to the gas chambers."
The boy scooped up snow from the platform and threw snowballs at the train. One of them exploded on the grate near me, and I was showered with slush and ice. I was angry, until I realized the snow was water, and that I was dying of thirst. I licked what I could off my face and my shirt. The train lurched, and we were off again, the boys taunting us and throwing more snowballs at us as we left.
"And you wanted to escape,"
a man near me whispered to another man.
"You wanted to run off into the woods and fight. But do you see? Do you see what the rest of them think about us? These people would sell you back to the Nazis for a sack of potatoes, and then toast you at the dinner table."
We did not arrive at our destination that night, nor the entire next day, and we still had no food or water. I drifted in and out of sleep, that blessed escape from hunger. I would have collapsed from exhaustion if I hadn't been held up by the prisoners squeezed in around me.
One morning or night, I couldn't tell which it was, I woke up to find the man next to me leaning heavily on my shoulder. I shook him to wake him up, but he wouldn't open his eyes. Something about the way he stood there, something about the way he moved, stiff and awkward, made my skin prickle. His flesh was gray, like a Muslim's. His lips cracked and frozen at the corners. Then I realized he wasn't breathing. The man leaning on me was dead. I squirmed and twisted, trying to push him away, but there was nowhere for either of us to go. The men near me roused from their sleep to grumble at me to be still, and I gave up. The dead man would be my companion until we got to wherever it was we were going. I worried I wouldn't be able to sleep again, knowing there was a corpse leaning on me. But soon the cold took me, and I re-entered the half-awake world of the barely alive. I woke again to an orange horizon. A sunrise? A sunset? My throat was cold and dry, my tongue like burlap. It had snowed while I was asleep, and the ventilation grate near me was covered with the stuff, grayish white from the engine's smoke. I tried to reach it with my tongue, to lick some of that precious frozen water off the grate, but it was just out of reach. My arms were pinned at my sides by the crush of people in the car, but I wanted that snow. I needed that snow to survive. Slowly, painfully, I pulled my arm up between the dead man and the sleeping one beside us. The sleeper muttered in his sleep as I jostled him, and he pushed my hand back down without even waking. But I had to have that snow. I pushed again, and again the man pushed back. I elbowed him in his sunken stomach. He whimpered in his sleep and stopped fighting. My arm was free. I scooped snow from the grate. My thin fingers were so cold they were blue, but I didn't care. I shoved the snow in my mouth like a toddler eating cake. My throat was so dry I gagged on it, but I forced the melting snow down, ignoring the shocking pain in my teeth from the cold. It was water. Wonderful water. Not even a pastry at the corner bakery on Lvovska Street had ever tasted so good. With a pang, I remembered going there on Thursdays with my father, eating a treat and watching the pigeons in the park while my father read his newspaper. I pushed the memory away and reached for more gray snow. The orange horizon turned out to be a sunrise, which turned into a bright blue winter morning. Our train slowed again, this time not for a station. We were shunted to a sidetrack while another train of cattle cars passed us, going in the opposite direction. The other train slowed, then stopped alongside.
"You there!" someone called from across the way. "You there! In the other train!"
I squinted through the slats in the wall. There were people in the other train, packed in like us. We were all Jews being shipped around to occupied Poland like coal or meat.
"What?"
a man a meter or two away from me answered.
"What does our train say? Where are we going?"
the man in the other train asked. I hadn't thought the trains would have our destination on them, but most trains did, I remembered. There were plates at the top that could be switched out for different destinations. I peered through the slats at the other car, trying to see.
"Treblinka,"
I called, seeing the placard at last.
"It says you're going to Treblinka."
I didn't know the place.
"Where are we going?"
"Birkenau,"
the man in the other train called. I had never heard of Birkenau either, but the word spread through the train in scared whispers. Birkenau. 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 The other train rocked and started moving again, and soon we too were on our way. The man next to me, the live one, mumbled and shook his head.
"What is it?"
I asked.
"What's Birkenau? Another work camp?"
"You don't go to Birkenau to work,"
the man said, his voice hoarse and dry.
"You go there to die. Birkenau isn't a concentration camp. It's a death camp."
A chill ran through me. The boys at the depot had been right, I realized. They had known. The Nazis were going to kill us. They were going to turn us into soap. The train rocked back and forth, back and forth. Outside, it began to snow again.
"You want my advice?"
the man next to me rasped.
"When they take us to the gas chambers, try to stand right under the exhaust vents."
"Is that how you survive?" The man laughed. Or tried to.
"No, you won't survive. None of us will. But if you stand under the exhaust vents, you won't suffer as long before you die."
Birkenau Concentration Camp, 1944 to 1945. Chapter 16. The train arrived at Birkenau at night. The cars clanked and groaned as the train came to a stop half a kilometer outside the gates. It was a cloudy night, and should have been dark, but the sky was lit up red like a bonfire. Black chimneys stood up in silhouette against the glowing sky, shooting flames from their tops, and the smell of burning flesh filled the air. I gagged. I waited for the train to move again, to take us into that awful factory. But we didn't move. We sat for what must have been hours, all of us who could see out watching the flames, knowing that was where we were going. Why were they holding us here? Was this one last torture? One last joke? Did they want to drive us to panic? To madness? If they did, it was working. The longer we waited, the more anxious I got. What was going on? Why weren't we moving?
"What are they waiting for?"
I said at last, my voice hoarse from thirst and fear.
"Don't you see the fires in the chimneys?" a man next to me said. "They have to finish off the last trainload before they have room for us."
I took in his words, too weak to react. We were just another raw material, waiting to be processed. Shovel us in, shovel us out. I dozed again. Every time I woke, I was still in the cold train car, a dead man leaning against me. At last, the train jolted and began to move, and I woke for good to a pale yellow sun rising above the trees in the distance. They were taking us inside to the furnaces. They were taking us inside to die. The train car door opened. For a few steps, the dead body next to me came with us, held up between the living as we pushed for the door. But soon there was more space, and he fell, slumping to the floor with the others who had died on the trip. There were dozens of them, rag and bone skeletons who had perished of hunger, or thirst, or the cold, or suffocation, or overwork. We climbed over them, gulping in the fresh air outside before the capos and soldiers whipped us and shouted at us to line up. We assembled in a field just beyond the train cars, those of us who survived, looking more dead than alive. After another roll call to see which of us were still alive, the Nazis marched us toward one of the big brick buildings with chimneys. So this was it. The reality began to sink in, and I slumped under its weight. They really were going to kill us. I had come so far, endured so much agony and suffering. I had survived the work gangs in the ghetto, baked bread under cover of night, hidden in a pigeon coop, had a midnight bar mitzvah in the basement of an abandoned building. I had watched my parents be taken away to their deaths, had avoided Amon Gert and his dogs, had survived the salt mines of Yelichka and the sick games of Chabinya. I had done so much to live. And now, here, the Nazis were going to take all that away with their furnace. I started to cry, the first tears I had shed since Moshe had died.
Why had I worked so hard to survive if it was always going to end like this? If I had known, I wouldn't have bothered. I would have let them kill me back in the ghetto. It would have been easier that way. All that I had done was for nothing. In a large empty room, we were ordered to undress and pile our striped uniforms in a corner. In a different corner was another stack of clothes. Silks of bright red and blue and purple and green. Gypsy clothes. Now we knew who had fed the fires of Birkenau while we waited our turn outside. I was still crying as I pulled my shirt off and added it to the pile. The tears came unbidden, but I didn't try to stop them. Some of the other men were crying. Most weren't. I didn't care. I was tired. Tired of fighting. Tired of being brave. Tired of surviving. They whipped us and beat us again to herd us into the next room, where showerheads lined the ceiling. I remembered what the man on the train had said, that you died fastest if you stood underneath one of the showerheads, where the gas came out. Instead, I moved away from them, near one of the stone columns set throughout the room. They packed us in again, just like on the train, but there was still a little room to move. When the door clanked shut, some of the men cried out. By now, we all knew why we were here and what they were going to do to us. Some people panicked and beat on the door, yelling for the Nazis to let us out, to have mercy, to spare us. Some people cursed them. Some people closed their eyes and muttered prayers. Some just stared off into space, waiting to die. Tears streamed down my face, tears I didn't know I had left. And I slid down the column to the ground, burying my head in my hands. Mother, father, my aunts and uncles, my cousins, my friends in Krakow. I miss them all so much. We waited, but no gas came. The cries of the men grew louder and more desperate. I stayed frozen to where I sat, not knowing what to think. Why were they waiting now? Maybe someone was standing on the hose, I thought crazily. And I started to giggle. Yes, that was it. Or maybe they couldn't get the fire for the furnace going. Maybe the match kept blowing out. Or the kindling wouldn't catch fire. I laughed out loud at that, and a prisoner standing over me looked down at me like I was insane. Maybe I was. The Nazis had finally broken me. It was all a big joke. I could see that now. There was no rhyme or reason to whether we lived or died. One day it might be the man next to you at roll call who was torn apart by dogs. The next day it might be you who was shot through the head. You could play the game perfectly and still lose. So why bother playing at all? Still, the gas didn't come. I pulled myself to my feet and pushed my way through the men until I was standing right underneath one of the showerheads. Go on! I yelled at the showerhead. Go on, do it! I dare you! I laughed again. What are you waiting for? I cried. Kill me! I give up! You win! The pipes rattled and moaned. Something was finally coming out. The men in the room got quiet, like we were all holding our breaths, and I reached my arms up toward the ceiling. Kill me, I prayed. Please kill me, and put an end to this. I'm ready. Water rained down on me. Freezing water, so cold it made me scream. Water! Not gas! I was going to live! I laughed and cried, and so did the other men. We celebrated as we shivered, hugging one another and shaking hands, all of us granted a last-minute reprieve by the Nazis. I was alive. Chapter 17. After the shower, nothing seemed to matter as much to me. I knew it was a game to the Nazis.
Kill us, don't kill us. To them it didn't really matter. But even so, I was glad I had made it through. I had been ready to die. But when water came out of those showers, not gas, it was like I was born again. I had survived, and I would keep surviving. I was alive. The Nazis lined us up, still naked and shivering. First, they shaved our heads. With our hair gone, we all looked alike, young and old. Next, they marched us to a different room, where soldiers waited at tables with what looked like big, oversized pencils with wires attached to them. As we worked our way toward them, person after person, I could hear screams of pain ahead of us. I had no idea what they were doing to us, but they weren't killing us. That was all that mattered, I told myself. I could handle pain. By the time I got to the head of the line, I understood what was happening. We were being tattooed. I watched as the man ahead of me had letters and numbers carved into his skin in black ink with an electric needle. When it was my turn, the Nazi with the tattoo pencil grabbed my arm and started to write. The pain was awful as he dragged the vibrating needle over my skin, but I knew better than to cry out or beg him to stop. Besides, nothing could be worse than what had already happened to me. I had been in a gas chamber. I had looked up into a showerhead and waited for death to come, and it had passed me by. I was alive. A tattoo was nothing to me, not in that moment. B3087. That's what the Nazis carved into my skin. B for Birkenau. 3087 for my prisoner number. That was the mark they put on me, a mark I would have for as long as I lived. B3087. That was who I was to them. Not Yannick Gruner, son of Oscar and Mina. Not Yannick Gruner of 20 Krakuza Street, Podgorze, Krakow. Not Yannick Gruner who loved books and science and American movies. I was prisoner B3087. But I was alive. After the room where we were tattooed, we were taken to another room with a huge pile of old, used prisoner uniforms and told to find something that fit. The soldiers made us run, beating us with clubs if we took too long to find new pants and a shirt. So we took whatever we could as fast as we could. I ended up with pants that were too short and a shirt that was too big, but I was lucky to get a pair of wooden shoes that fit. That was important. Shoes were everything in the camps. I moved fast and wasn't beaten. I could play the game as well as anybody. I had made it this far, hadn't I? I was alive. When we were showered and tattooed and dressed again, we were taken to our new barracks. They were worse than any barracks I'd seen yet. The ground at Birkenau was like a swamp, wet and thick with mud, and there were no floors in the barracks. There was no heat or electric light either. The bunks weren't beds, but shelves, stacked three tall on top of one another, and they stuffed us in again as they had on the trains. There were no mattresses, no pillows, no blankets. Just old, wet straw when there was anything at all. There were so many of us we could only all lie one direction or we couldn't lie down at all. It didn't matter. I was alive. I couldn't help thinking it over and over again. I felt something at my feet, deep inside the shelf, and I reached down to get it. It was a scrap of colorful cloth, a bandana or a handkerchief, probably left there by one of the gypsies who'd slept in these bunks before us. I tucked the scrap up under my head, hoping to use it as a bit of pillow against my ear, but there was something hard inside it. I unknotted the cloth and found an object hidden within. A little wooden horse. It was a simple children's toy, a rough carving that just hinted at four legs and a head. But it was smooth and dark, like it had been played with. Some gypsy boy or girl had loved this horse, had somehow kept it with them always, right up until the very end. Had they known they were going to die? Had they left their little horse behind so it wouldn't die with them? So some part of them might survive and be remembered?
"We have a boy who is 13 today,"
a man on my shelf said. I raised my head, as did one or two others.
"Who will stand with him?"
No one stirred.
"Are there not 10 men here who will make a minion with us?"
"Be quiet,"
someone told him.
"Go to sleep. How can you care about such things in a place like this?"
someone else asked.
"It is even more important here and now,"
the man said. Someone scoffed.
"Tomorrow he will be dead. We all will. None of it matters anymore."
I was tired and starving, and my arm burned from the tattoo. But suddenly, I thought standing in a minion for somebody's bar mitzvah was the most important thing in the world. Worth losing sleep over. Worth being punished or killed.
"I'll do it,"
I said. The men around me were quiet for a minute after I spoke. And then someone else said yes. And another. And another. When there were 10 of us, we climbed down onto the muddy floor, and the man who had first spoken began to pray. More men came down then, more than 10, until we filled the whole ground. The boy looked so young, but I knew I could be only 1 or 2 years older than he was. With a start, I realized I had probably missed my own birthday. I was 15 now, maybe even 16. It was winter, but I had no idea what month it was, let alone what day. I had been in concentration camps for more than 2 years. I looked at the boy and remembered my own hasty bar mitzvah in Krakow. I had been so young then, a lifetime ago. The ceremony was fast so we wouldn't be caught. When it was all over, the men all whispered Mazel Tov and climbed back onto their shelves. I went up to the boy and pressed the wooden horse into his hands. The only present I could give him. The boy looked at me with big, round eyes. Had I ever been so young?
"We are alive,"
I told him.
"We are alive, and that is all that matters. We cannot let them tear us from the pages of the world."
I said it as much for me as for him. I said it in memory of Uncle Moshe, and my mother and father, and my aunts and other uncles and cousins. The Nazis had put me in a gas chamber. I had thought I was dead, but I was alive. I was a new man that day, just like the bar mitzvah boy. I was a new man, and I was going to survive. Chapter 18. I stood at the water pump scrubbing my body. It was bitterly cold out, but I didn't care. I would scrub my body, I decided, each and every morning, no matter how cold it was, no matter how tired I was. I was alive, and I meant to stay that way. We had no soap, but at least I was able to wash away the caking dirt of Birkenau. I paid careful attention to where I had been tattooed. Too many others had let their tattoos get infected, and that had taken them to the camp surgeon. You didn't want to go to the camp surgeon. Ever. I even rubbed my teeth with my wet fingers. We had no toothbrushes or toothpaste, of course, but it felt important to remember what it was like to be human. As I scrubbed the taint of Birkenau from my body, I read the signs the Nazis had posted above the water pump.
"The block is your home. Maintain cleanliness."
And,
"One louse, your death."
Big jokers, the Nazis. You could play by the rules, keep yourself clean, do everything right, and still the Nazis would kill you for looking at them wrong. But I played the game. Work at Birkenau was as bad as everywhere else. Here, as in Płaszów, we were to build new barracks. The ground for the new section was so big it would double the size of the camp when it was finished. The Nazis called the new camp B3, but we prisoners called it Mexico. I don't know where the name started, but Mexico always sounded exotic to me. Warm and sunny, with beaches and laughing faces. Maybe that's why the prisoners nicknamed it Mexico. To make them think of something very different from what B3 really was. The camp storehouse, where the Nazis kept all the valuables the Jews from towns and villages brought with them when they first arrived, we called Canada. Food was weak coffee substitute in the morning, watery soup at lunch, and bread at night. The bread was hard and tasteless, and had to serve as breakfast as well. The soup was tepid, and you were lucky if there was a limp potato floating in it. I learned a trick with the soup, which was to wait a while before lining up for it. The heavier parts of the soup sank to the bottom. If you were among the last in line, your soup was thicker. I almost always got some chunk in my soup by holding back until the end. Just that little bit of extra food might keep me from becoming a Musulman. We were forbidden to go out at night, so instead of the camp latrines, we had to use a barrel in the barrack if we had to go to the bathroom. There were two barrels for 500 people, so we learned to go to the latrines during the day as much as we could. There was one latrine per prison block, really just a row of holes cut in boards that sat over the cesspit. Prisoners stood guard at the door with clocks. Their job was to make sure no prisoner spent more than 2 minutes in the latrine. If you took longer than that, an SS guard would go in and beat you with a club until you left. There was to be no dawdling at Birkenau. The joke was on the Germans this time, though. By leaving the same prisoner stationed at the latrine, the one place we all had to go throughout the day, they gave us secret postmen. The Nazis never wanted us to talk to one another, but if you ever had a message for someone else, you could whisper it to the prisoner on watch at the latrine door as you went in. He would remember it and quietly whisper it to the recipient when he came to take care of his business later that day. One day, as I went into the latrine with another prisoner, I heard the watchman whisper, "Tonight." I didn't know what the message meant, but it wasn't for me anyway. That night I was fast asleep on my shelf, slotted in with all the other prisoners in my barrack, when shouts startled me out of my sleep. Capos and SS guards were in the barracks, yelling at us to get up and smacking at prisoners with their clubs. I blinked, disoriented and scared, but I managed to tumble off my shelf. This was something new for Birkenau, where usually they let us at least sleep through the night. We quickly assembled in the yard, standing in rows, and I could tell immediately that something was wrong. The floodlights in the towers weren't sliding lazily over the grounds like usual. They were turned outside, where they swept the woods quickly back and forth. Guard dogs barked beyond the barbed wire fence surrounding the camp, and cars and tanks rolled by outside.
"Prison break,"
a man next to me whispered.
"A prison break? Who? How?"
My heart thumped in my chest.
I wished I was with them, whoever they were, running for the forest, the hills, anywhere but here.
"Get out," I prayed for them. "Get away. Fly." A Nazi came around, checking our numbers against the clipboard. There were always prisoners who couldn't get out of bed again, who had become Musulmaners. That's what the Nazis wanted, anyway, to kill us with work and starvation. But which of the missing prisoners were dying back in the barracks, and which of them were running free in the woods? The Nazi grabbed my hand and read the number on my arm, then moved on to the next prisoner. My wrist still hurt where he'd grabbed me. His grip was so tight. The Nazis were mad. Prisoners weren't supposed to stand up for themselves. Prisoners weren't supposed to escape.
Will they make it out? Where will they go if they do? Could I escape from Birkenau too?
I wondered.
Could I live in the woods eating berries and nuts, sleeping out in the cold?
It couldn't be worse than the camps.
And maybe not every Pole was like the awful boys throwing snowballs at the train station. Maybe some sympathetic Pole would take me in, hide me in their barn.
We stood for hours, late into the night. They even went through the roll call again, as though some of us might have slipped off in between, which didn't seem possible. Then, almost at dawn, there were shouts of excitement from the Nazis beyond the fence. The gates were opened, and a ragged bunch of prisoners were marched back inside, all beaten and bloodied. I immediately felt sick to my stomach and swayed on my feet. The escaped prisoners hadn't made it. They'd been caught,
How, I didn't know. And how many had run and how many they'd caught, I didn't know either. But these men hadn't made it, and the price would be severe. The SS officer of the watch sneered at us.
"There is no escape from Birkenau," he cried. "No escape. Perhaps some of you are thinking about running. There is no one waiting to help you on the outside. There is nowhere for you to hide. You will be caught, and here is what we do to those who try to escape."
They lined the men up against a wall in the assembly yard.
Rat-tat-tat-tat!
The watch officer gunned them down himself, riddling their bodies with bullets.
"Bring forward their work detail,"
the guard cried. Other men were pulled out of the ranks. Prisoners who had done nothing but work alongside the men who'd run. Prisoners who hadn't tried to escape.
Rat-tat-tat-tat!
The SS man shot them too. Then the soldier turned the gun on us in the roll call ranks.
Rat-tat-tat-tat!
I closed my eyes and prayed the bullets wouldn't find me, trembling as prisoners were hit and fell dead to the ground all around me. I couldn't move, though. I couldn't run. If I flinched, I would be singled out and shot.
"This is the punishment for escape. All of you will share the blame,"
the watch officer yelled. He shot until the machine gun ran out of bullets. Click, click, click. The SS officer threw his weapon to the ground.
"Clean up this mess,"
he ordered, and he marched away, leaving us to carry away our own dead. That night, in what little sleeping time there was left, I dreamed that Amon Gert was chasing me with his dogs. I ran and ran and ran, but I could never quite get away. Then one of the dogs leaped and bit my left arm. I woke up screaming and holding my burning left arm. My left arm, where the Nazis had carved B3087 into my skin. Auschwitz Concentration Camp, 1945. Chapter 19. After a few months at Birkenau, we were told Auschwitz needed workers. Since Auschwitz was nearby, a sister camp to Birkenau, they marched us down the road and across the fields to get there. Our capo stopped us at the station, where we waited for new prisoners to join us. You could tell they were new because they stepped off the trains in real clothes, not camp uniforms, with their luggage and children in tow.
"Leave your luggage,"
the Nazis told them.
"Why, we were told to bring it with us,"
they argued. The Nazis promised them it would all be returned to them in due time, and the new prisoners believed them. The Nazis loved having new prisoners who didn't know what was coming. It amused them. I could only feel sorry for these new arrivals. They had no idea the waking nightmare that lay in wait for them.
"Have you heard of Auschwitz?"
our capo asked the new prisoners.
"No. Someone's waiting for you inside. Do you know who?" "Death, of course. Death waits for you. Look and see."
The new prisoners kept their distance from us veteran prisoners as we were herded toward the main gate. They looked at us with wide eyes and pulled their children away from us. Did we look like monsters to them? I glanced around at the other prisoners who had come with me from Birkenau. We were skin and bones with shaved heads and shuffling gaits and red skin on our arms where they tattooed us. Our eyes were sunk into our heads, our ears stuck out like donkey ears, and we must have smelled wretched, though of course we'd all been long accustomed to our stench. I was 15, maybe 16, and I looked like a 60-year-old man. To these people just off the train, we all must have looked like escaped mental asylum patients with our shaved heads and our wooden shoes and oversized blue and gray striped uniforms. If only they knew that this was what awaited them. If they weren't taken right to the gas chambers and the furnaces. We passed under the front gates of Auschwitz, where the German words, "Arbeit macht frei," were written above the gate. I knew enough German to translate it. Work makes you free. A smiling SS guard told us a very different story as we passed.
"You come in through the front gate," he said. "But the only way out is through the chimney."
I looked up with the new prisoners to the tops of the brick chimneys, where a thick black smoke poured out into the blue-white sky. The crematorium. Little flecks of gray fluttered down all around us, collecting on puddles of water in the yard. I watched a little girl in a blue dress catch one on her tongue like snow. I didn't have the heart to tell her it was the ashes of the people who had come before us. I recognized the assembly yard before they ever told us what it was. They all looked the same. A big muddy field surrounded by barbed wire fence with a bullet-ridden brick wall, especially for executions. Auschwitz prisoners in charge of crowd control organized us into a single file line. One of them shambled up the line, whispering urgent advice.
"You're 18, you're in good health, and you have a trade. You're 18, you're in good health, and you have a trade."
"What?" said the man in front of me. He wore black trousers and a black vest over a clean white shirt, and he stood with his wife and their young son. The boy couldn't have been more than 10.
"What did that man say? Why should I tell them I'm 18?
"Your boy," I said.
"Tell them your boy is 18 and has a trade."
They recoiled when they saw me. Monster that I was. "See if you don't look the same in a year," I thought.
"What? But that's preposterous. He's 9, he's just a boy," the woman said.
I left it. A Nazi soldier was walking by, and I wasn't going to get caught talking. We had been lined up so someone at the table ahead could process us, and slowly I made my way to the front. 3 Nazi officers sat at the table. The 2 officers on the sides wore brown shirts and pants, but the man in the middle wore the black of a senior officer. He looked immaculate, with a shining black cap, polished medals, and neat white gloves like a traffic policeman. No one was so clean in a camp ever, not even the camp commandants. This was a man of importance, I could tell right away. He held a baton in his right hand, and with a flick of it to the left or right, he was separating the line. One direction, I knew, would be for the camp work detail. The other would be for the furnaces.
"Good material this time,"
I heard him say as we got closer.
"Yes, Herr Dr. Mengele,"
one of the brown shirts told him.
"Next,"
Mengele told the family in front of me.
"How old are you?" "I am 39, my wife is 36, and our son is 9,
the man told Mengele.
"Are you healthy?"
Mengele asked the man.
Yes, only my wife had pneumonia recently, and she is still weak from it."
I closed my eyes. The man was telling them too much and not the right things.
"Your occupation?"
Mengele asked.
"I am a clerk." "Not anymore,"
Mengele told him. He waved his baton to the right for the man and to the left for the woman and the little boy. Kapos came and pulled them apart.
"Wait, where are you taking them?"
the man asked, looking terrified.
"Papa,"
the boy cried. He reached for his father, but an SS officer pulled him and his mother away, while another officer pushed the father to the right.
"Next,"
Mengele said to me.
"How old are you?"
I stood as tall as I could.
18,
I lied.
"Are you healthy?" "As an ox,"
I lied again. It was all I could do not to waver as I stood.
"What is your occupation?"
I could hardly tell them student. The man before had said clerk, and he'd been lucky they'd kept him.
"Bricklayer,"
I lied again. Herr Dr. Mengele pointed his baton to the